This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Matt Lee, renowned Charleston cook, author, and we're going to talk about the republication of Princess Pamela's Soul Food Cookbook and find out a little bit more about this woman from Spartanburg, South Carolina, who became a New York City institution. Matt, welcome to the Journal.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I'm sorry Ted can't be. He's in Rome.
He's on hiatus, but this elderly brother can sally forth.
Matt, when the email started going back and forth about his being in Rome, I think Alfred had first got the wrong Rome, you know, like
Rome,
maybe,
Georgia.
Like Rome, Georgia. And that took me back to another mutual friend of ours, Dory Sanders.
Yes.
20 years ago, I called her up and said, Dory, I'd like to extend an invitation for you to be a part of our conference next August, and it's going to be in Denmark. And she said, Walter, I love you, but who in their right mind is going to go to Denmark, South Carolina in August? I was talking about the other Denmark, and she went and was an incredible hit, but that was the first thing that came to mind is Denmark.
There's a whole world contained here in South Carolina, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about Princess Pamela and who she was. She's kind of a mystery woman.
She's an incredible story, truly. And she popped up on our radar screen back in the earliest days of our moving to New York in 1994. We were right out of college, desperate to find jobs in New York. And that's about when we hit on the idea, well, if we can't find a job, at least we can boil peanuts. So imagine our surprise. We were on the Lower East Side when just around the corner there was a restaurant whose sign proclaimed Princess Southern Touch, Cuisine of South Carolina. I mean, we had come all this way from Charleston and, you know, envisioned ourselves as rattling around the, you know, hurly-burly of New York without a friend in the world. But the idea that we might find a good pot of greens right around the corner on the Lower East Side was pretty absurd and fantastic. But as we come to know, she was much more than just a restaurateur. She was one of those New York institutions. She had had a long history in New York by the time that we found her. She probably set up her first restaurant around 1964, 65 on East 10th Street in the East Village. And from the start, it was a very quirky, like only someone from South Carolina could set up this kind of restaurant. It was basically a speakeasy in an apartment, and you had to know where to go and to ring buzzer 2A. And she'd throw down the keys. There were maybe only three or four tables in the restaurant and a jazz band more numerous than the customers often. And platters of fried chicken, greens, black-eyed peas, oxtail, a lot of the sort of standards of what in the 60s came to be known as soul food. But it was much more than just the food. It was this whole environment, this hospitality that she created in the place where it was a little bit of tough love. You know, you had to know about it to get in. There was a little bit of a hazing at the door. And once you were in, you had to behave. You had to mind. She had rules. You didn't complain about the creaky chairs. You had to ask for permission to use the bathroom.
Well, it was her home after all.
It really, I mean, that was the privilege. Like if you were let in, you know, it was a great privilege. You know, she took care of you and she constructed evenings of great flavor and quality for her patrons. And you can imagine, try to imagine back in the 1960s in New York City, you know, heading into the Vietnam era, like just how, you know, frightening New York was. It was just rough and tumble and not a pretty scene. And then to be welcomed into that precinct, and especially if you're from the South originally, to be treated in the way that your Southern grandmother might treat you would be priceless. So Craig Claiborne, Mississippian, mm-hmm. fell in love with her restaurant. And
he was the food critic for the New York
Times. That's right. His business was to find out about great restaurants in New York and to write about them. And he clued into this one pretty quickly. And it started to become a little hit. And she attracted a cast of great celebrities, including Diana Ross, Muhammad Ali, Jackie Onassis, Gloria Steinem, Skitch Henderson, Pearl Bailey, you know, just a great cast of New York thrill seekers of all sorts came through her restaurant. And that's when she got her cookbook deal. So around about 1969, she was about 40 at the time, this wave of publicity resulted in her getting a major cookbook deal with a New American Library. So she published a cookbook with about 147 recipes in it, and it went out to the world, distributed nationwide. And it was part of a wave in 1969 of soul food cookbooks. So it sort of got lost in the shuffle. And I see you're holding it in your hands. It's this tiny brown, crumbly, newsprint quality, almost airport paperback.
Well, that's what a paperback was in the 60s.
Yeah. It got, it wasn't accorded great acclaim. Ted and I collect a lot of Southern cookbooks from every century that we can collect Southern cookbooks. Now we've got three centuries pretty much. But this one didn't really stand out visually. What attracted us to it, aside from the fact that we had briefly met her, was that the quality of the manuscript, like the recipes themselves, are such an interesting and unusual deep dive into the professional cooking, and especially the African-American cooking of upstate South Carolina. Now, that's a tight slice of the Southern food pie, but a really interesting one to us. And it's not boilerplate Southern. It's not soul food as the 1960s understood it.
Let's just stop a minute and talk about the concept of soul food.
Yes.
It became commercialized and bastardized and stereotyped and what have you. It's almost like buying Cajun. Anytime I see something like blackened on the menu, I avoid it like crazy because I grew up on the Gulf Coast with good Gulf Coast cooking. And what, you know, just put a little bit of hot sauce on. That's what these people do. Make it hot, blacken it, and it supposed to pass.
Yeah. So the concept of soul food is hard to define. We all have tried at various times and in various ways. But the best definition that I've found comes from a friend and colleague, I don't know whether you've read him, Adrian Miller. He wrote the definitive book about soul food in 2013. And he says, fundamentally, it's easy to understand. Soul food was the celebration cooking of Black America. And what he means by that is the dishes that are in the canon of soul food were really the foods that in Black America were the Sunday celebrations, the wedding food, the funeral food, things that were not eaten every day. And when some people react instinctively to the concept of soul food by thinking, oh my God, unhealthy foods, it's that they're absorbing that fact that these are truly celebration foods. And so if you were to move north and open a restaurant, as Sylvia Woods did, as Pamela Strobel did, you would furnish that restaurant menu with the greatest hits, the everyday food, the kinds of things that actually made it into Princess Pamela's cookbook, you probably wouldn't serve, especially to a white audience. What's interesting is this cookbook, Princess Pamela's Soul Food Cookbook, came out in 1969. There were no fewer than 12 other cookbooks that had the word soul food in the title. But I'd wager that this was the only one that had a recipe like hog jowl and turnip greens in it, or pigtails and butter beans. Probably the only cookbook that had chard mentioned, Swiss chard, the diversity of different kinds of Southern dishes expressed in this cookbook are amazing and really almost put to shame our current diversity. You know, we live in an era where heirloom vegetables of every variety and stripe are available to us. And yet back in the pre-World War II era, you know, Pamela Strobel, her mother, Beauty Strobel, her uncle Isaac in Spartanburg were channeling an even wider range of ingredients.
I know that there's a recipe for possum in the cookbook.
Of course.
But see, this is one of the issues about soul food. If you were to look at upcountry South Carolina in the 20s and 30s, and it was a majority white area, it was not a majority of black population like
right.
most of the rest of the state, the working class white folks were cooking exactly the same thing.
Yes.
And there was no black person in the kitchen. But the idea of possum, and I've heard this from several folks who grew up as children in the 1930s, the idea was to trap a possum at Thanksgiving, fatten him up, and then he would be stuffed with sweet potatoes, or sweet potatoes would be around the possum, and he would be baked that instead of turkey, which you could not buy. And the idea is that sweet potatoes would help sop up the grease because possums are pretty greasy.
Fairly greasy. Do you speak from experience?
I am not speaking from experience, but I have spoken to people who actually ate that dish, and they liked it. Older folks who are no longer with us, but they can remember during the Depression, farm families, our chickens, we'd rather have them for the eggs than to cook them. So.
Right. Well, as you know, this country moved out of a largely agrarian past to a more urban pattern. So many of those things that were considered commonplace became exotic. President William Howard Taft, I learned this in the most recent issue of Garden and Gun, Julia Reed has a whole fascinating essay about possum. And William Howard Taft, it was his favorite meal. Now, that's elite cooking, elite Washington cooking back in, 1909. But yeah, we look through and we see backbone and dumplings is one of the recipes in her cookbook. And we know that that's pork backbone. It seems implicit almost. But that nose-to-tail eating that is considered so au courant is simply the kind of cooking that goes on in well-run agrarian enclaves, whether it's Europe or Asia or the American South. Mm-hmm. You know, why would you waste that stuff?
You know, people used to have a squirrel.
Yeah. I mean, thrifty and prudent. I mean, why would you waste good flavor if it's all around you? Mm-hmm. And that idea that you can layer on sort of a value system that says that, pigtails are less worthy than tenderloin is totally a late 20th century thing. And I think most thinking people now realize that that's to be avoided. To make those judgments. If you care about good flavor and good eating, give me a break.
Anyway, back to Princess Pamela's cookbook. It's not a traditional cookbook.
We haven't even begun to touch the surface of what intrigued us about this book. One thing is, I think you're pointing at it, is that it's as much poetry as it is recipe. On the facing page of almost every recipe, there's a little poem, proverb, little saying, something she made up that sometimes refers specifically to the possum recipe or whatever's on the other page, sometimes not. But in aggregate, just you get this full sense of this woman born in about 1928 and who made the Great Migration to New York under terrible circumstances.
Yep. That story is known when she had shared that story.
Yes.
Her mother died when she was, 10 or 11?
She was 10 when Beauty died. And there was no one, leastwise, no kin of mine, it made a difference to if I went to bed or the next morning I woke up at all. That's the first lines in this book is a poem to the soul of Beauty, Beauty being her mother. Who was a chef at the elite restaurant in Spartanburg, but who moved from town to town seeking jobs. She was a pro chef and was in demand by, I presume, summer colonies in Massachusetts, and was in Massachusetts when she realized that she had some fatal illness, probably cancer, moved back to Spartanburg to her mother, Pamela's grandmother's house, and ended up dying there. 2 years later, Pamela's grandmother died. And so she was basically orphaned in Spartanburg and set a course north to Winston-Salem first, probably at around age 13.
Well, I see, here is a young black girl getting on the bus, at the back of the bus. Of course, she had a segregated bus. Makes you wonder, did she stop at Winston-Salem? Because is that all the tickets she could have afforded, and that's as far as she could get? I mean,
it's hard to know. We did find a nice interview that had been done with her in 1992 where she elaborated a little bit more on her biography and her origins and her passage to New York, and we're able to excerpt some pieces from that. But she describes going to Winston-Salem with her hair in three pigtails and a paper suitcase, and that was it. And the bus dropped her off in the worst part of town near the R.J. Reynolds tobacco plant. She talked her way into an elderly woman's restaurant and started by washing pots and pans, standing on a Pepsi crate to reach the sink, and then she started cooking. And that's when, you know, beauty's cooking intelligence started coming out of her own two hands. She then moved to Virginia Beach and fell in with what she refers to multiple occasions as a shake dancer, Vizie Dubois. And then the two of them move up to New York City.
Or what is the shake dancer?
I don't know. I can picture it. I mean, it's pretty descriptive. So Vizie Dubois, this interesting character, I mean, we've got to make a movie out of this, right? Mm-hmm. Is dancing in nightclubs in New York and Pamela's cooking in them. Then we don't really know what happened until 1965 when she opened her first restaurant. But presumably she was cooking. And the rest is sort of history. I mean, she continued cooking. Her restaurant operated on East First Street, right around the corner from our old tenement, until 1997. And by then, she was not actually cooking so much. She had a woman, Ada Spivey, cooked for her mostly in the later years so that Pamela could preside and play hostess. And also, if she was feeling right, take the microphone, put on her wig, and sing with the band. And you knew you were in for a special treat that night if she locked the door, kept any new customers out, and put on her gown.
Did you ever witness one of those?
I didn't. Ted and I knocked on her door with a bag of boiled peanuts, hoping that she would take them on spec and sell them in her South Carolina restaurant. And she opened the door a crack and sort of humored us and heard us out, but she was not interested and no thank you. And on subsequent occasions when we went there, she'd peel back the curtain, take a look, and decide we weren't, you know, high enough rollers for her restaurant.
So
we never actually dined there.
Oh, okay.
We've interviewed hundreds of people who have. And the stories are fairly consistent. You know, people just fall – initially are taken aback by some of the constraints of the experience, but then the food just – changes their mood, smothered pork chops, sweet potatoes, buttermilk pie. You just never knew what was going to be on the menu, and you didn't have much choice. The menu is pretty tight.
I love the story, and there's a nice article about her, about the young couple who went there, and the young woman's date got very snarky about sweet potato pie not being on the menu, and they got kicked out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you didn't mind, if you brought any kind of attitude, that was Ruth Reichel, the famous former gourmet editor and New York Times restaurant reviewer back long before she started her career. This was in the late 60s or early 70s. She was there with some friends from out west, and they brought some attitude. He was surprised that there wasn't sweet potato pie on the menu and made a sassy comment, and she kicked them out into the street. That was common. Or she'd just, you know, shout loudly over her shoulder to Ada, like, let's get on with table number three. I want them out of here, you know, that kind of thing, so that she could cultivate a perfect night for the people that remained. This is a familiar way of running a business. If you've ever worked in an independently run auto repair shop in the state of South Carolina, you know that you select your customers.
I'm trying. Was this a one seating affair? I'm just trying to think, you know, as the evening wore on, I mean, I'm trying to get the feel for the restaurant.
I mean, get a feel for what your what your, you know, crazy aunt's, you know, happy hour is like. Sunday.
It was only open for dinner, right?
It was only open for dinner and whenever she felt like it. So you could go there on a given Friday and it might not be open. She kept the roll gate, you know, those sort of security gates that proliferated in New York City in the days when people would drive a car through the plate glass to steal things. She'd keep that roll gate about a third down at all times, even when she was operating, to project that image that we might not be open. It was a way of creating a barrier to entry that helped her filter out the bummer customers.
Yeah. So that was after she moved from her apartment to the—
That's right, yeah. To East First Street, a tiny little storefront. And, you know, furnished with mostly home-style equipment. There, in some photos, we can see a KitchenAid mixer on a sideboard. A lot of people talk about the black refrigerator, home-style. She talks in the cookbook about, even in her restaurant, cooking off of very standard home appliances in the kitchen. And yet, I mean, this going to Princess Pamela's restaurant was one of those things that made New York, New York.
And it was not a large restaurant. What, she went into an actual restaurant?
It was tiny. If she could accommodate 15 people, that was a full house. But over 40 years, you know, almost 30. You know, you can service a lot of people and make a lot of memories.
You mentioned that each recipe has a poem with it, and I just happened to open to this one, which I think speaks to it. And it's the recipe for cornbread dressing. Mm. But the poem is, "My uncle used to tell me, early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. I've been following that routine all my life, and I can tell you that all it does for a woman is to make her tired, poor, and not too bright."
She had a lot of words of wisdom about how to handle men and about being a successful entrepreneur in hard times and a hard climate. I mean, imagine trying to make rent in New York City as an independent businesswoman and a black independent businesswoman. You know, the fact that she succeeded, that she attracted national attention, got her book published. Andy Warhol wrote about going to her restaurant in his diaries. She catered and sang the Paris Review's 40th anniversary party in the Hamptons at the Vanderbilt Estate. I mean, she was very well, you know, absorbed into New York society and culture at a very high level for many decades. I can't say many people have done that from the restaurant world.
No. And then she disappeared.
And this is a cautionary tale also about New York. I'm portraying a New York that sounds so frightening, but it's actually a great place to begin a business because of the volume and the customer's appetite for cool stuff. And you know, she's an example of that. People willing to pay any price to have oxtails served to them in 1970s New York City. But yeah, so the cautionary tale is that to be old in New York is a terrible thing, and to be poor as well. If she was not quite as successful in the 90s as she was earlier on, it would be easier for her to slip away into a New Jersey nursing home or to die in her third floor walk up on Stanton Street and to be carted off to Potter's Field, to Hart Island. We just don't know.
You and Ted have tried to track down through Miss Spivey, who was her cook.
Well, in so many ways. We tried for a family connection in Spartanburg and came up empty. We've done all the census record searches to try to define when she was born, what her birth name might have been. It was almost certainly not Pamela. and was more likely Addie Mae or Mary. There were two daughters born to the person Rosella, who's almost certainly Beauty, in 1927-28. And then she talks about this, about how her grandmother's friends would come around on the weekends, and she referred to them as her
They were playing mama.
Well, the point is—
She called them play mamas.
Play mamas, yes. So Pamela's play mamas were her grandmother's friends who would come over and just chat on a Saturday afternoon and rename her and call her Mary, Catherine, Pamela, Rose, Strobel, and have fun with that fluidity of naming. And she loved that. And so she hit on the name Pamela at some point and took that as her own. But flash forward to, 2012, you're searching for the records for a woman who might be alive, might be dead. You're not sure of her actual name. She might not have ever had a driver's license. There's also privacy laws that kick in. So we did, we hired a private investigator. We did a lot of just calling the landlords of her former restaurants and the successors to those landlords. We talked to the place that sold her paper napkins and takeout containers, who's still in business. And we randomly called a few nursing homes that were proximate and in the sort of, Tri-County area, Brooklyn, New Jersey, Connecticut, just hoping for something to turn up. Our greatest hope is that just this show and some of the events we do will hopefully upstate will turn up some kind of lead that may indicate what happened to her.
That is the hope. And you would think maybe some of her family or kinfolk might be left in Spartanburg, but she was part of the Great Migration, and the family may all have gone somewhere, not just to New York.
That's right. This was, not long ago in the grand scheme of things, but quite a long time ago in terms of, we're talking like maybe three generations ago, 1938, 39.
Is there somebody who remembered, my grand went to...
Yeah, well, there's another ingredient, though, Walter, which is interesting. It comes right in that first paragraph, first sentence of the book, in that poem, To the Soul of Beauty. I was 10 when Beauty died, and there was no one leastwise, no kin of mine. It made a difference, too. So there was some problem that she or her mother had with the family. She's sort of throwing her kin under the bus there. Mm. And we don't know what that was either.
Matt, we've got to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Matt Lee, and we're discussing Princess Pamela's Soul Food Cookbook about Pamela Strobel, a young woman from Spartanburg, South Carolina, who went to New York and became literally one of the city's institutions. Matt, I opened to one of her poems, and I almost got the giggles.
Which one is it?
She poked her head into my kitchen and asked me if I cooked chicken with a thermometer. I told her, ain't had any get sick on me yet. It's wonderful. How did you go about, this little paperback, lots of white space. They're not really recipes. They're almost... In the traditional sense.
Well, we've come to expect these kinds of excruciatingly over-described recipes of the sort that the Lee brothers publish in their cookbooks that, tells about every twist of the pepper grinder practically. And these are actually very well-rendered and specifically rendered recipes, but they're definitely in an older style that's more spare, more open-ended, presumes a little bit more. But I find it refreshing to read these.
Well, you weren't really denigrating your recipes, but you have to create a cookbook for contemporary cooks who want every, as you said, three bay leaves the size of the tip of your finger or whatever.
You want to erase all doubt. But you know what? That's just not possible, ultimately. We're the pendulum swinging back, I feel. We were handed this incredible opportunity, which is to take a cookbook we thought was, you know, beautifully said but not very well rendered physically, and to reconceptualize it, to make it sing, to rebuild it. And Rizzoli handed us this opportunity to begin a whole series of old cookbook reissues of worthy projects that we thought needed a new audience and a new life. And this was our first, but it took place on many platforms. There was the text and the recipes, which we engaged by actually retesting. We applied our, 2017 principles to the recipes so that we could push the recipes a little closer to readers today and give them hope that they could complete these recipes successfully in their own home kitchens. So there are a few editor's notes that we added. We did reorder the ingredients to follow the order in which they are used in the steps, which is a classic modern standard in recipe publishing. But other than that, we really left it alone. The other aspect is the design, which we handed to Gail Anderson, who is the design director for Rolling Stone magazine for 15 years, most of the 1990s and into the 2000s. And she and her partner, Joe Newton, did a beautiful job of scaling this up and making it a hardcover, giving it more permanence, but also giving it a sense of color and motion without adding photographs. We're never going to like reshoot or shoot any photographs for this. But the original had these cute line drawings that reference certain kitchen implements and food ingredients. And they reproduced some of them as pure facsimiles, but they also created a few others. They're very clever about the way they went about it, the way they used type. It just feels like a modern cookbook with a heritage to it. You know, that comes through. But most importantly, we didn't want to disturb the beautiful synergy between the poetry and her humorous and poignant sayings and the recipes. You know, the great cookbooks of this world are great because they bring together imagery, instruction, you know, the recipes themselves, storytelling, and the physicality of the book in a way that's, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 = 7. We felt that about her book from the start and loved the way that it turned out, mostly thanks to the designers.
It's not a facsimile reproduction.
It's not,
But it is laid out the way hers was. On one page, you've got the poem, and the facing page is the recipe.
Is the recipe, yeah. Can I read you one?
Sure.
I love this one. It's very simple but pleasurable. It's opposite the oxtail ragout. She spells it R-A-G-A-W. Think of an oxtail gravy or ragu if you prefer. But so the poem facing it says, "When you hear somebody sighing and eating with his eyes closed, then you know somebody in the kitchen keep hers wide open." There's also she expresses a philosophy of the kitchen that is very open-ended and relativistic. Like, you know, she talks a lot about imperfection and how, you know, you can't make the same recipe the same way twice, but even so, it's all good. And she talks a lot about love and kindness and how it's the soul and heart of the chef who makes the food taste good. And as long as you have that, you can't go wrong. No two people can cook up the same recipe in exactly the same way. There's a secret ingredient, and it's in the cook, not the recipe. That is love and kindness.
I was just looking at dishes that I know you don't see on the table. Scrapple, tripe. Oh, she has several recipes for tripe.
There are three recipes for tripe. There's two recipes for coconut cake, both of which call for freshly grated coconut. There's every single part of the pig. From heart to tail to backbone to jowl, everything. And in fact, there's quite a lot of baking. And we attribute that to the fact that her mother and her uncle were skilled bakers. Her uncle was singularly a baker. And so out of this 147 recipes, 67 involve some kind of baking, flour, corn, meal, pretty much if you're looking for some kind of peach or sweet potato experience, it's in here. There are no fewer than 12 sweet potato permutations.
How many different ways are you going to cook sweet potatoes?
Well, let's just go to the index, my friend.
All right.
Sweet potatoes, biscuits, sweet potato cake, sweet potato candied, fried sweet potatoes, mashed sweet potatoes, sweet potato pie, sweet potato pone, pork chops and sweet potatoes, sweet potato skillet pudding, roast possum with sweet potatoes, sweet potato tarts, and yam biscuits. That's a depth of Southern cooking that you just don't find in many places. This really preserves the cooking of South Carolina, especially upstate South Carolina, from the 19-teens and 20s. It was published in 1969, but that's not what's being presented here. It's more special than that.
I earlier talked about possum and sweet potato. I had not looked at her recipe, but her recipe matches what I said earlier.
Yeah.
Now, scrapple, that's not really a soul food. That's a German. But then you've got that upstate, which were where the Great Wagon Road brought all sorts of people.
I think in this case, it was the New York publishing system of the late 1960s that wanted a soul food cookbook, mm-hmm. a cookbook with the word soul food on the cover that applied that label to this cookbook, which is something different entirely. Mm-hmm. It's black folk cooking, for sure, mm-hmm. but it's a much, you know, a deeper dive on a specific region, specific type of African-American family that's a professional family, professional chefs. The other thing that we feel was imposed on this book was terribly sort of obtuse introduction that was unattributed. It's just a little condescending. It just tries to define soul and does so in terms that see Southern food as odds and ends, scraps, leftovers, and nasty bits, basically. And in cooking through the book, one thing we also discovered that we suspect was an imposition by the publishers was that all the seasonings, hot pepper, Tabasco, Worcestershire, fresh garlic, were dumbed down to almost undetectability. And so what we felt we had to do was call that out, first of all, and encourage readers today to double or triple the seasonings as called for. There was the red rice recipe, for example, called for 1/8 of a teaspoon of Tabasco. Now, one for a dish serving 8 people. So each person would get, what is that?
Not even a drop.
1/64. And simply to get to the point where those seasonings are detectable, I'm not saying like bold or powerful or anything like that. And so we went throughout and corrected for that.
What did you suggest instead of 1/8 of a teaspoon of Tabasco?
I think at least a teaspoon. I'll have to look it up. But we have little editor's notes that call out a specific multiple, like triple the garlic, quadruple the vinegar, you know, that kind of thing. Try to remember the food of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. What was white people food of the 1960s? You know, cream sauces. Think about that whole rapture about French cooking. Think how frightened people were of Italian cooking at that time, and the intensity of sun-dried tomatoes and dried peppers from China and stuff were all considered highly exotic. Our taste, thankfully, has evolved to embrace chili peppers of all sorts. I mean, you know, there are South Carolinians and Southerners of all types who embrace chili peppers. But it was kind of a closet indulgence, you know, to come out with a cookbook that celebrated them in the way that the chilies are celebrated in Mexico, for example, would be, you know, unheard of back then. Now it's a bold statement and almost necessary to embrace, you know, big flavors, flavors sourced from all over, and to use them creatively the way a professional chef would.
You're talking about how things were imposed on the book, and it makes you wonder, was it just because they were dealing with soul food, or they were dealing with a black woman, or quite frankly, at that time, whether you were black or white, if you were Southern, the snooty folks in New York wanted to say something or not say something.
Well, Ted and I have been working in New York publishing from a South Carolina perspective for long enough that we know this feeling very well when they either want to dress you up in overalls as a hayseed and smooth out the complexities of Southern life, or they're just entirely afraid of what you're offering because they simply don't understand and have never traveled to the South. It's a parochialism. I mean—
It is a parochialism, and it's something that I'm afraid still with us.
It is, absolutely. But, you know, as long as you're aware of it, you can control for it. And the great thing about New York publishing is that they are looking for the next great thing, and they're open to the possibility that it's something they least expected. And as long as you're aware of the way they work and their limitations, you can work it as hard as the Lee brothers have worked it.
Do you find now that people are cooking less at home than they used to?
That's a hard question to answer because on the one hand, many more people are cooking than ever before. Elderly men enjoy cooking on Friday evening instead of going to the movies. So do 10-year-old kids, both male and female. So we've got that trend away from a kitchen defined by women, which is encouraging. But then again, we also have many more options for instant eating, delivery, and prepared foods, and many more supermarkets proffering so many different options that, yeah, you know, there's two countervailing trends. But in general, we're much more optimistic than we are pessimistic, and the numbers back it out. That's why we're publishing cookbooks, is it's a very strong category of publishing. There's something about the combination of instruction through the recipes and inspiration that you get from a book and this other ingredient, aspiration, this desire to be like the people who created this world of recipes and to bring that into your home life that really make it a super effective and super value-packed piece of publishing. People love to own books. The ebook version of all of our cookbooks, you know, does terribly, maybe a tenth of what the physical copies do because of that immediacy, which I only think is enhanced more as our life becomes more digital, that we crave holding that cookbook in our hands, cracking it open, leapfrogging through it, something that's very hard to do digitally, to get that quick take, then to carry it with you to your summer home or your vacation, and the giftability. You know, there's no better gift. I mean, now we have the opportunity to select from, you know, a whole range of worthy projects like this and give them a new life.
Well, Princess Pamela and who she was, she's kind of a mystery woman. The Humanities Council has been sponsoring various Main Street exhibits. Mm-hmm. And in the towns where those have happened, all of a sudden people have come out with stories. So maybe somebody is going to come out and say, well, my grandmother used to go to be one of the play mamas or
yes.
Something like that.
Oh, gosh, I would love that. That would be my dream. We know that her grandmother was a member of the Majority Baptist Church, which is still thriving in Spartanburg. Pamela even said that her grandmother's name is engraved in the cornerstone. So we're hoping to fact check that one and to meet some of the clergy there.
Well, who knows? And if it happens, let us know because, again—
We'll report back.
Yeah. This interest in local small-town history— Of course, I love it, but it's been a boon to the communities.
Yeah, when communities of any size embrace their heritage and history and really begin to explore it and understand it in smart and meaningful ways, it redounds. Everyone benefits, and the place becomes more fun and more hospitable.
All right. This is the first in what's going to become a series?
That's right, called The Lee Brothers Library.
Okay. And I know you have literally hundreds of cookbooks.
Yes.
Are they all going to be Southern cookbooks that you—
Actually, no. Our interests certainly center around Southern life and American history. but they range far and wide. If you've been reading our travel stories for Travel and Leisure magazine, we've been to New Zealand and the Rhone Valley and all over Ethiopia. So this series will really range widely, and we have to be very selective. I mean, not every fantastic old book deserves a new shell. Some of them were published perfectly back then and don't need any intervention of ours. So the next one in the series is a totally different take on republishing because it's going to be a facsimile edition of a cookbook that sold hundreds of thousands of copies, if not a million, back in 1964 before this one was published. But it comes from a totally different place. Do you remember The Galloping Gourmet?
Yes.
Graham Kerr?
Mm-hmm.
His first American cookbook we hope to republish. And the reason is that it's a beautifully modern cookbook. It was published perfectly the first time around, but America wasn't quite ready for it. They gobbled it up simply because he was a TV food star of the sort that we don't even have today. I mean, he was on network television with hundreds of millions of viewers on every show. He was a super god in food TV. Long before the rest came along. And so he did very well. But this cookbook is ready for its new audience. It's so beautifully rendered. And the recipes reflect, in their own way, his experience in New Zealand and Australia. He was stationed there for 7 years when he composed this cookbook. And so there are elements of, you know, New Zealand cooking in there that we find pretty interesting, especially since this cookbook was aimed at an American audience. And there's less required of us. We're not going to be testing and retesting the recipes. What we will be doing is going out to Graham Kerr, who's alive and well and living in the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle area, and spend time with him and really try to get to the heart of what animated him about food back then, to try to get a little deeper into who he was and what his food was about. He wasn't taken very seriously because he was so popular and so charming and so profane. Julia Child and James Beard and the rest really quite detested him. One of those called him the Liberace of food.
Of course, Liberace was a showman.
Yeah, and what's interesting to us is that Graham Kerr's showmanship and his relationship to food, the way he cooked, the way he was self-deprecating, feels very now. We think that, you know, he and his mindset about food would be very well received now by our current national atmosphere about food and play and home life.
Well, Matt, I'm sorry that Alfred really is giving me the wind-up sound effect. If we don't stop soon, he's going to cut us off.
We'll go into hour two, no problem.
So, any last words?
We're really fortunate, in a way, that Princess Pamela was published back in 1969 because she's one of the rare few of her era who got this kind of spotlight, and we always have to remind ourselves how many like her didn't get that spotlight and labored in obscurity just as brilliant as they could be, whether it was New York or in Spartanburg or Charleston, for that matter. And so we hope that this will inspire other people to collect those kinds of histories and oral histories that allow us to broaden the perspective we have on the great state of South Carolina.
Okay. All right. Well, Matt Lee, thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
It's my pleasure.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did. It's always fun to have the Lee brothers on the journal, and we just had Matt today. Ted's in Rome, Italy, not Rome, Georgia. But the story that brought Matt here, the republication of Princess Pamela's Soul Food Cookbook, is quite a saga, and it's a very special South Carolina story of a young African-American orphan leaving Spartanburg, South Carolina, and eventually ending up in New York, where she becomes, in the 1960s, a culinary legend and the toast of the town. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal. Next time on Walter Edgar's Journal, my guest will be Professor Rod Andrew of Clemson, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Life and Times of General Andrew Pickens.
They had been courting Pickens. They had been trying to convince Pickens to accept a British commission. And then this one Tory officer, probably Major James Dunlap, makes the stupid mistake of forever antagonizing Pickens. But what really grabbed me about the story is that at that point, when Pickens decides he's going to rejoin the Whig cause, he doesn't just slip off into the hinterland. Instead, he goes straight to the nearest British garrison, finds senior loyalist officer present, and announces to him that he considers himself released from the terms of his parole due to the violence done to his property and his family, and he's rejoining the cause for American liberty. Captain Kerr begs him not to do this. He said, if you're ever captured, you'll be hung for treason. And Pickens is courteous but adamant. And he walks out, mounts his horse, and rides away, and within a few weeks reemerges as one of the heroes of the Cowpens campaign.
Join me for Walter Edgar's Journal, a production of South Carolina Public Radio, Friday at noon.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.